This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, episode 21, Sourdough Starters and Pre-Ferments. I'm back. Welcome to the Stella Culinary School Podcast, your online resource for learning how to cook like a professional chef. In this episode, we continue our bread baking series talking about sourdough starters and pre-ferments. In the discussion segment, we'll be going over what a pre-ferment is and how it can make your bread much, much better. And then in the technique segment, I'm going to teach you how to make your very own sourdough starter, which really isn't that hard. So break out your chef coats and aprons. It's time to go to class. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name's Jacob Burton, and thank you so much for joining me. And man, it feels good to be back on the mic. And I want to thank everyone online, all my friends who send me emails and all the people on the Facebook page who are just constantly hassling me, asking me, hey man, when will you be back on the mic doing long form audio podcasts? And it has been quite a while. If you've been hanging out with me over on stellaculinary.com, you know that I've been super busy over there, mainly working on a lot of video content. And then also, starting a couple years ago, we've been doing an annual hands-on culinary boot camp. And that's been a lot of fun. It took me a lot of time to set that up, as far as I wrote a completely brand new curriculum, basically my theory on the creative process of how to create food and understand it on a deeper level. And so I created this curriculum called the F-Step Curriculum, which means F-Step is the five steps that I use to analyze food and to create new food. And the F-Step is flavor, sauce, technique, execution, preparation, and just the curriculum that kind of explains my philosophy and the science and technique behind these five steps is 50,000 plus words, not to mention our actual recipe handout book. That ranges, I believe, in the 30,000 word mark. So a lot of content, and it's a lot of fun because we literally shut down the restaurant for a week and accept only 12 students. And we get a bunch of hardcore cooking fans in there, and we cook breakfast and lunch, lunch and dinner every day. So we start with a morning lecture, cook lunch, then we go and we take a little afternoon break, come back and cook dinner, and it's a lot of fun. But so that's what's been keeping me real busy on my end of the spectrum. And also, too, the restaurant Stella has been getting a lot of great, amazing accolades, which are very humbling. And because of that, we've just been getting exponentially busier. But I am happy to be back on the mic, continuing our bread baking series in the long form audio podcast. Now, let me just say this before we really kind of dive into this episode's content. The last three episodes of the Stella Culinary School podcast were 18, 19, and 20. So 18 was the four pillars of bread. 19 was the 12 steps of the bread baking process. And 20 was the classification of breads. And each one of those episodes talked to you about some of the basic fundamentals behind bread. So in episode 18, we were talking about different kinds of flours, yeast, and how those interact. In 19, we were talking about the bulk fermentation process and the proofing process and how changing the environment can have an effect on your bread. And then in 20, we were talking about the classifications of bread, mainly the indirect method versus the direct method, and how certain additives, as far as, you know, fat content or salt content or sugar content, could change how your bread dough reacts. And that was all laying the foundation for this episode and the next episode, which are basically advanced level talks on bread baking. So if you haven't yet listened to those podcast episodes, if you're unfamiliar with some of the basic concepts of the baker's percentage and don't understand hydration rates when expressed in a percentage, or you don't understand indirect versus direct method or any of those things, then I would stop this right now and come back to it later. You know, listen to our 18, 19, and 20 episode, and then check out our video on the Baker's Percentage online. You can find all of our bread baking videos by going to stellaculinary.com/SB, and that stands for Stella Bread. So you go there, that's our video index. We have a little lecture on the Baker's Percentage and some other things on how to bake bread. Now, if you're comfortable with all of these basic bread baking techniques and understand the basics of pre-ferments and, or excuse me, the basics of yeast and flour and indirect versus direct method, then listen on because this episode is just for you. In this episode's technique segment, I want to talk to you about the concept of pre-ferments. Now, our jobs as cooks is to extract the fullest flavor of any ingredient that we use through the application of knowledge and technique. Now, I've said it many times before, and I'll say it again, technique is king. If you listen to me at all while I do these podcasts, if you listen to any of our past podcast episodes, you always hear me preach technique is king. And that's why I'm so obsessed with the bread baking process, because it's one of the purest showcasings of technique, whether good or bad. We all start with the same four basic ingredients, flour, water, salt, and yeast, yet through the application of technique, we transform these humble ingredients into greatness. So how does a pre-ferment help us accomplish those goals? Well, a pre-ferment in its simplest form is flour and liquid, usually water, mixed together with a very small amount of yeast that is then slowly fermented over the course of hours and as long as a few days. Now, once fully fermented, meaning the pre-ferment has at least doubled in volume and kind of reached its full expansion and is starting to slowly collapse in on itself, the pre-ferment is then added to the rest of the ingredients in the bread recipe. Now, this would fall under what we call the indirect method. So in episode 20 in our classifications of bread, we were talking about how you have the direct method, which all the ingredients are mixed together, and then you go through the 12 steps of the bread baking process. So you mix it, you bulk ferment, punch down, form, proof, bake. Now in the indirect method, you basically are either retarding fermentation during the bulk fermentation process or the proofing process, or you're slowing down and elongating fermentation by pre-fermenting a portion of the flour and liquid that is called for in that total dough recipe. Now, a pre-ferment works because fermentation is extended, allowing more time for the yeast and natural enzymes contained within your bread flour to take action on the starch and proteins in your dough. Now, this has a few benefits. Number one, like I discussed in our other bread podcast, the general rule of thumb is the more prolonged the yeast fermentation is, the more flavor you will achieve. And this is true up to a couple of days, after which there is a law of diminishing returns, mainly because the yeast runs out of food, starts to die, resulting in your bread having off flavors. Now, pre-ferments will also add extensibility to your doughs, making them easier to form and resulting in a superior oven spring. In fact, pre-ferments have been shown to increase the oven spring of baguettes by as much as 10%, which of course results in an airier, lighter crumb. Now, a pre-ferment can also, because you're slowing down fermentation, a pre-ferment will slightly acidify the dough. Nothing crazy like if you're using a sourdough starter, but the acidity of the dough will drop a little bit, and this increase in acidity of the dough caused by the delayed fermentation will actually increase the shelf life of the bread without having to add any additives or what we call dough conditioners. Now, to create a pre-ferment, a portion of the flour and water is taken from a bread recipe and mixed together with a very small amount of yeast and then allowed to ferment at room temperature for about 5 to 18 hours. But the real sweet spot is 12 to 16 hours being the norm at room temperature. Now, this is then incorporated into your final dough mix and used to leaven a loaf of bread. So the salt, although important in the final dough formulation, is not commonly used in a pre-ferment because salt is a yeast inhibitor. So sugar is also a yeast inhibitor. So if you're making a sweet dough recipe, normally the sugar is left out in the pre-fermentation process or the pre-ferment and then is added later on using when you create the rest of that dough. Now, yeast love to feed in general on the nutrients of bran and germ of whole wheat flour, which means when making a whole grain bread, you can use some or all of the whole grain in your pre-ferment to make gluten strands more extensible, which means a better rise and texture that's less dense in your finished product. And this is a common issue when baking whole wheat breads is, like we talked about in previous episodes, if the percentage of whole wheat flour is more than 20%, so if you have, you know, say 300 grams of whole wheat flour and 700 grams of bread flour in your dough formulation, you're basically looking at 30% of your flour is made up of whole wheat bread, then you have issues with that whole wheat bread becoming dense, mainly because the germ in the wheat or the whole of the wheat is actually sharp. And it will cut into the gluten strands, shortening the gluten strands and giving you less oven spring, less of a rise, and an overall denser bread. Yet when you create a pre-ferment using whole wheat bread, you're giving that yeast time to break down some of that bran and the germ of the whole wheat. And you're also softening the bran and the germ of the whole wheat, which is going to give you a better oven spring and a better texture. Now, pre-ferments can go by many different names, and you'll hear them called everything from chef to levain, sponge, madre bianca, mother, starter, biga, poolish. But I like to think that there are three pre-ferments that encompass all the other pre-ferments. And in fact, I'm going to kind of coin a phrase here right now, and we'll see if we can get it to catch on. I'm going to call these the three mother pre-ferments. Get it? You know, like mother sauces. And that's because there is a lot of crossover terminology, but these three mother pre-ferments have slightly different approaches depending upon the result that you're looking for. Now, the first of these three pre-ferments is the poolish, which is really the most commonly used both at home and in professional bread bakeries. And this is sometimes also referred to as a sponge or barm, although barm can also be used in the context of a sourdough starter, which we'll talk about more in our technique segment. Now, the poolish is basically distinguished by the fact that it's a 100% hydration starter, and it's always going to be a liquidy batter. Now, some people will have a higher hydration or a slightly lower hydration, but for me, I like to keep a 100% hydration because that means I have equal parts flour and water mixed together. And then when I use this poolish at my final formulation, it makes it a lot easier for me to do some simple math to adjust my total formulation of like hydration point or salt. So, I mean, if you think about it, if I have 500 grams of poolish starter, I know automatically, just by definition, because I always make it a one-to-one mixture, that I'm going to have 250 grams of water and 250 grams of flour contained within that poolish starter. And because of that, I can just add that amount of flour, add that amount of water without doing any math to my total formulation and figure out exactly where my hydration rate is, exactly where my salt content needs to be. So it's really easy to do your baker's math when using a poolish pre-ferment. And at room temperature, a poolish starter will be ready to go in about anywhere from 12 to 16 hours. But this all depends on how much yeast you add to your poolish. Obviously, more yeast equals less time. And also, the temperature of your room equals less or more time. And like we discussed in our past episodes, basically anytime you increase the room temperature by 17 degrees Fahrenheit, the yeast will double in its activity level, or decrease by 17 degrees Fahrenheit, the yeast activity level will be cut in half. So let's say that you usually create a poolish starter at a 60 degree Fahrenheit room temperature, which is really kind of cold, to be honest with you. I mean, room temperature usually ranges from about 68 degrees to 72 degrees Fahrenheit. But we're going to use 60 degrees as my example to make my math easier so I can do it on the fly here. But basically, so say it takes your poolish starter to be ready to use or to fully ferment in about 24 hours at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, you raise that by 17 degrees Fahrenheit, which is going to give you 77 degrees Fahrenheit room temperature. And now your pre-ferment, which took about 24 hours to be ready, is now going to take 12 hours to be ready. So be conscious of the fact that the more yeast you start with, the faster your pre-ferment will be ready to use. And the hotter your room temperature is, the faster your pre-ferment will be ready to use. And this isn't always desirable. If you're looking to save time, then the pre-ferment process or the indirect method probably isn't for you, because the whole purpose of the pre-ferment process is to slow down fermentation and utilize that to create a better finished bread product. Now, in the case of your Poulsch or any other pre-ferment, if you're not going to use it right away, say after the 12 to 18 hour mark at room temperature, you can store it in your fridge for up to 3 days. Now, after that, your bread will start to have a little bit of off flavors due to the weakening of the dying yeast cells. Now, the basic formulation for a Poulsch starter is 500 grams flour, 500 grams water, giving you 100% hydration, and 1 gram yeast, which is 0.2% by the baker's percentage. Now, again, there are other formulations for Poulsch, but this is my favorite formulation that I use because it's real easy to remember. Your starter, your pre-ferment is going to be ready in about 12 to 18 hours. And anywhere between that 12 to 18 hour window, you can actually bake with it. So 12 hours is going to be a little bit early, 18 hours is going to be a little bit late, but you can use it within that window. And the 1 gram yeast, or the 0.2%, is just easy to remember and easy to formulate. However, don't get too caught up on the yeast amount. Again, the more yeast you add, the faster your pre-ferment will be done. So for something like, so, I mean, I know 500 grams flour, 500 grams water, that's kind of a lot of starter for someone to use. So if you want to use a smaller amount of a pre-ferment, if you want to create a smaller pre-ferment, then I would just say add a 1 finger pinch or a 2 finger pinch of active dry yeast. And that's it. You pretty much, you know, 100 grams flour, 100 grams water. With that small amount of flour and water, just take 1 little finger pinch of active dry yeast or instant dry yeast, whatever you have on hand, pop into your water, and then mix it with your flour. And you should be ready to go, because, again, the yeast is going to double as it propagates and create more and more yeast to use in your pre-ferment. Now, the next style of pre-ferment is called a biga, and this is used in Italian baking, most commonly for ciabatta. Now, I use the term biga to refer to a low hydration pre-ferment. Now, in Italy, the word biga is actually pretty much interchangeable with any pre-ferment. So sometimes it'll be loose, sometimes it will be stiff. But for the most part, traditionally speaking, a biga is a stiff style of pre-ferment. And then outside of Italy, biga is usually used just to describe any pre-ferment that is a low hydration. So your hydration rate for a biga style pre-ferment is usually going to be about 60% hydration, although, again, it can vary depending upon your formulations or who's giving you the recipe. But don't get too caught up in that, because hydration rate is just basically personal preference. But you are going to range from about 60% hydration, and then the amount of yeast that you add, again, doesn't really matter, in the sense that the smaller amount of yeast that you add, the longer it will take for your pre-ferment to be ready to use. The more yeast you add, the less time it will take for that pre-ferment to be used. Now, because yeast will propagate faster in a higher hydration dough, there is, traditionally speaking, more yeast added to a biga pre-ferment if you want it to be ready in the same timetable or time window of a Poulsch pre-ferment, which is that 12 to 18 hour window. So in a Poulsch pre-ferment, for that to be ready in a 12 to 18 hour window, we're going to add 0.2% yeast by the baker's percentage. For a biga to be ready in that same amount of time, we're going to add about 1% yeast by the baker's percentage. Now, this doesn't mean you have to increase your yeast, but just be ready for that biga pre-ferment with a 0.2% yeast by weight based upon the flour. It's going to be not ready to use for about 24 to 36 hours, again, depending upon your ambient room temperature and all that stuff. Now, once mixed together, this biga pre-ferment is going to resemble more closely a bread dough, a stiff bread dough at that, than the sponge of a Poulsch. Now, again, so the thicker dough takes longer to develop because the lower hydration impedes the yeast's movement and propagation. But this will also increase or give the dough more time for the acid in that dough to drop, which is going to give you a more stable bread, as far as that bread's going to last longer if you use a biga. And not amazingly so, but it will last a little bit longer. And also, anecdotally speaking, I find that a biga will give you a little bit closer of a taste to a sourdough starter. because that slower, longer fermentation required with Abiga is going to create more lactic acid and acetic acid in your dough, which is what gives sourdough its flavor. Now, will it taste like a sourdough? No, it won't. You can only achieve that through a sourdough starter, but it'll have a little more complexity than a Poolish starter. A Poolish style starter is going to give you more floral, flowery notes, versus a Biga is going to give you some more depth of flavor and acidic notes. So your basic formulation for a Biga is going to be 500 grams of flour, 300 grams water, and 1% yeast. Now you're going to ferment this at room temperature for 16 to 24 hours before incorporating it into your final batch of dough. Or you can retard this or slow down the fermentation by placing it in your refrigerator for up to 3 days. Now you can also freeze unused portions of the biga, which is better done by the second day, since the alcohol produced by the yeast can inhibit freezing. So if you try and freeze this on a day number three or day number four, the alcohol that's produced as a byproduct by the yeast is going to inhibit this dough from freezing. Now, before we talk about our final style of pre-ferment, let's stop for a second and talk about how much biga and Poolish pre-ferment you will need to leaven a loaf of bread. And again, this all depends on what your time frame is. So in general terms, if your room temperature is about 68 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, if you pull out half of your bread dough's flour and use that to create a pre-ferment, and you do that pre-ferment for 12 to 16 hours, then the next day when you take that pre-ferment and add it to the rest of the ingredients in that bread dough recipe, then it's going to take about anywhere from 3 to 4 hours for that bulk fermentation to occur and 1 to 2 hours for the final proofing to occur before you can bake it. So at about half of the flour, you're speeding up that process a little bit, but you're gaining a lot from the pre-ferment in forms of flavor and delayed fermentation. And this is important because even though you have to do a little bit of planning ahead, it really is just passive time to create better bread. So you say to yourself, okay, tomorrow I'm going to make a baguette. So I'm going to take half of the flour in my baguette recipe and an equal amount of water from my baguette recipe as the flour that I'm taking. And I'm going to mix that together. And because that's a one-to-one mixture, I'm going to be creating a Poolish style starter. And I'm going to let that Poolish pre-ferment for 12 to 16 hours. And then the next day, I'm going to mix the rest of the ingredients that recipe calls for into my Poolish. I'm going to allow it to bulk ferment for about 3 to 4 hours. And I'm going to let it proof for another 2 hours before baking and have a much better finished product than if I were to use the direct method for making a Poolish starter, or excuse me, direct method for making a baguette, where I just take all of the ingredients, mix them together, bulk ferment, punch down, divide, proof, and bake. And if you do less than half, so if say you take a quarter of the flour, so if your baguette recipe, let's just throw out a round number to kind of make it easier to imagine, if your baguette recipe calls for 1,000 grams of flour, and you take out 1/4, which is 250 grams of flour, and then you take out the equal amount of water from that bread recipe. So you subtract 250 grams and you add that to your starter. Now you have about a quarter of that flour in your bread recipe taken up in the pre-ferment. Now when you add that pre-ferment back into the rest of your ingredients the following day after it's ready to use, it's just logical to think, well, because I have less pre-ferment and less yeast by volume in that pre-ferment, then it's going to take longer for this bread to bulk ferment. And again, because you're taking a longer time and you're slowing down that fermentation, so maybe now your bulk ferment takes 6 to 8 hours and your final proof takes 2 to 4 hours, well, you're going to create a better, more complex bread. So whether you're using a Biga or a Poolish style starter, you want to take out anywhere from about 1/4 to 1/2 of the flour to create your pre-ferment, and then add that back to the rest of your ingredients the following day. Now, the reason why we talked about that before our final style of pre-ferment is because this is a little bit different. It diverges from the rules a little bit. And this style of pre-ferment is called a pâté fermenté. And this is also known as the chef or old dough method. And this is really convenient for people who bake the same style of bread on a regular basis. So basically, a pâté ferment or a pâté fermenté is the dough is mixed. So you use the direct method the first time you're making a bread recipe. So say you're making a baguette recipe. You're going to mix your flour, salt, yeast, and water together using the direct method. and then allow it to go through its full bulk fermentation process, punch it down. Now, during the dividing stage, right before you form the loaves and proof, all you're going to do is remove about one-third of the dough total from that recipe, and you're going to set that aside to leaven your next loaf of bread or your next batch of bread. And this can be placed in the refrigerator for up to 3 days, or it can be frozen for up to 6 months. So if you're making a baguette or if you're making some form of bread on a continual basis, I mean, say there's like a sandwich bread recipe that you really like that you want to use on a weekly basis to make your sandwiches for your lunch, or you like to have baguettes every couple of days with dinner, then this pâté fermenté or the old dough method is super convenient because you just basically whack off a third of that dough formulation, and then you use that to leaven your next batch of bread. And this is what Raymond Cavell, a very, very famous French bread baker, used to leaven his baguettes on a continual basis. And not only did it give it a better complexity of flavor, but he actually showed through various tests that it led to a larger oven spring of upwards of 10%. And a 10% more oven spring really gives you a nice, airy, light crumb as compared to something that was just leavened using the direct method where everything's just mixed together and baked off. Now, if you're going to be freezing an old piece of dough to be used later, then the only caveat is of course, you want to let this fully thaw before you incorporate it into your bread dough recipe. So if I was making baguettes and I whacked off a third and I placed it in my freezer and I decided 3 months later I'm going to make another batch of baguettes, I'm going to pull that piece of dough out of my freezer and allow it to sit at room temperature for about 12 to 16 hours and let it thaw completely. And that yeast will kind of start to reactivate. And once it starts to rise a little bit, then I know that it's ready to place back into my my bread recipe and to leaven that next batch of bread. Now, you can also take this piece of dough from the freezer and thaw it out in your refrigerator. But again, because you're thawing at a colder temperature, it's going to take longer. It's going to take a slower amount of time for it to thaw. And you're looking about anywhere from, I don't know, if I had to throw out a number, I'd say, 30 to 48 hours total, depending, again, on, how big the piece of dough is. So again, just to put it in simple terms, there are three major approaches to pre-ferments, your poulish being the high hydration, one-to-one mixture of flour and water, your biga being the lower hydration, stiffer dough of about 60% hydration, and then you have the old dough or the pâté fermenté, which is used to leaven the same style or same batch of bread over and over and over again. And again, like I mentioned before, the amount of pre-ferment that you use is going to dictate how fast or slow your final bread dough recipe goes through the bulk fermentation phase and goes through its proofing stage. But just by using any number of or any style of these three pre-ferments to delay fermentation is going to allow you to create some more complex flavors. Now, this complexity is limited to the fact that we're only be able to use pre-ferments over the course of 1 to 3 days, so it could only really develop so much character. So if you want bread with more character, that's where a natural levain or sourdough starter comes in. So in today's technique segment, we're going to talk about how to make a sourdough starter, and it really isn't as hard as you think it is and as hard as other people make it seem. So let's cut straight to the chase and talk about what a sourdough starter is and, more importantly, how to make it. So to make a sourdough starter, you start by mixing flour and water together and leaving it at room temperature. Now wait 24 to 72 hours or until you see some bubbling. At this point, feed the starter every 24 hours, storing at room temperature. And on the 7th to 10th day, after this starter was, started, you can use it to bake, just like a pre-ferment. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. Just kidding. But now that you understand the simplicity of the sourdough starter, we can talk more about the little details behind it. But I want you to understand something before we go forward. A sourdough starter is flour and water mixed together, and because you have natural yeast in your environment, and you have natural lactobacilli in your environment, which is responsible a lot for the sour flavors of a sourdough, those are inoculated into your dough, into that flour and water mixture, and over time, if fed and refreshed, grows into a sourdough starter. Okay, so it really isn't this complex thing that people think it is. I mean, that's not true. There are some complexities behind it, but please don't overthink it, because we're going to now talk about these complexities, but don't get all glazed over, because I want you to understand the science behind it. I mean, that's what the Stella Culinary School podcast is all about. I want you to deeply understand the science behind a starter so you can understand what's going wrong with it or what, you know, why it's flourishing. But, you know, don't get too caught up in the science in the sense that it makes it seem more complicated than it is. Because again, it's flour plus water plus the natural yeast and natural lactobacilli that is in your environment that create a sourdough starter in just a little bit of time. So flour and water plus time equals sourdough starter. But what is an actual sourdough starter? Well, a sourdough starter can go by many different names, again, just like a pre-ferment. So it can be called a barm, a biga, a natural levain, a poolish. But they're really all the same thing, which is a mixture of the flour and water inoculated with the yeast and the lactobacillic bacteria, which occur naturally in your environment. Now, let's talk about the yeast for a second. There are two major species of yeast that can be utilized by bakers. And the first one is commercial yeast, which is known by its Latin name of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And this is used in winemaking, beer brewing, and bread baking. Now, the bread yeast you buy at the store, whether cake, instant dry, or active dry, are all part of the Saccharomyces cerevisiae species. In fact, the original etymology of this Latin term gives us a hint as to what it does. Sacro means sugar, mysis means mold or fungus, and cerevisiae means beer. Now, in fact, if you read any of Peter Reinhardt's books on bread baking, which I highly recommend, he'll often remind you that bread is solid beer and beer is liquid bread. Now, just so I don't lead you astray here, I want to give you a quick little side note, and that is Saccharomyces cerevisiae isn't used exclusively for beer making, but it's used mainly to ferment ales, which are normally fermented at temperatures of around 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius. And this is also commonly referred to as top fermenting, since the yeast floats to the top of the ale during the fermentation process. Now, lagers, which are, on the other hand, cold fermented, use a strain of yeast called Saccharomyces pastorianus, which can ferment at temperatures around 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 degrees Celsius, the same temperatures at which S. cerevisiae slows down to the point of almost being dormant. So just for my beer makers out there, lagers are fermented with a different yeast than ales are. And ales are fermented with the same species of yeast as we use to bake bread when we buy commercial yeast. However, don't get confused by the fact that even though they're the same species of yeast that is responsible for fermenting bread and beer, there are various strains within the Saccharomyces cerevisiae species that are used. So you can't really go and buy commercial bread yeast at your local supermarket and then use that to brew a batch of beer. So just a little heads up there. Now, the other form of yeast available to bread bakers is the wild form, and this is Saccharomyces deciduous, and you'll see this on the skin of fruits and vegetables, and you'll see this as a white haze, but it's pervasive throughout our entire environment. So if you go and you walk through a vineyard and you see that white haze on mature grapes, well, that is Saccharomyces deciduous, or our wild yeast strains that are the same species of yeast that are found in our sourdough starter. Now, there are various strains of S. deciduous, and they can live in harmony with one another, or they can go to battle with one another. It just depends upon the strains and how well they get along. Now, some sourdough starters will have multiple strains of yeast that live in symbiotic relationship with each other, and other forms of yeast that are really territorial and go to battle and can, you know, kind of wreak havoc on one another. Now, wild yeast is slower acting than commercial yeast, and this is why it takes a longer time for sourdough starters to first propagate, and it's also why it takes a longer time for a sourdough starter to leaven bread. Even when you use a large amount of sourdough starter, it still takes it a longer time to leaven bread than if you were to use Saccharomyces cerevisiae or just your common commercial yeast available. Now, living in your starter in symbiotic relationship with your wild yeast are many different species and strains of bacteria found in various different types of starters, and because they produce lactic acid while fermenting sugar, they fall under the heading of lactic acid bacteria, or LAB. Now, depending upon the kind of lactic acid bacteria that you have in your starter, and then what you feed your starter, you can have a different flavor. So a lot of the acid that is produced by a starter, or a lot of the acid that makes your sourdough sour, is basically reliant on two things. Number one, the kind of bacteria that you have in your starter. And number two, what you're feeding your starter. And you can actually create various environments that are more friendly to other bacteria than other bacteria, as far as in the lactobacillus bacteria family. So some will create more lactic acid, which makes the starter more sweet, flowery, and milky, where others will create more acidic acid, which is the same acid that's found in vinegar. And so it's going to be a more intensely sour bread. And this can be influenced by what you feed it or feed the starter and also how you store it. Now, there is a ton of science behind this, and it gets really geeky. And honestly, it's really fun to talk about. But we're going to save that for next episode when we discuss it in depth in our discussion segment. But just for now, you kind of suffice to say that a lot of the complex flavors of sourdough actually don't come from your yeast. It comes from the lactobacilli that lives in symbiotic relationships side by side with your yeast in your starter. Now, my approach to starters is fairly simple, and I'm going to kind of lay out for you how I do it and what's worked for me. Now, there are a lot of different forms of starters out there, and people have different approaches, but I'm going to talk about my approach and what's worked for me, and then we'll talk about some variations and some things that you can do to increase the likelihood of your starter getting going. But I'm a purist when it comes to creating a sourdough starter. And so my starter is 500 grams warm water that's filtered, 250 grams of whole wheat flour, and 250 grams of bread flour. So as you can see here, we're making a poolish style sourdough starter because it's 100% hydration. And I'm going to mix all these ingredients by hand, and I'm going to store it in a non-reactive container. So a plastic container that you can see through is my favorite because as this sourdough starter becomes more sour, then it's going to possibly react with metal containers. So just go ahead and place it in a plastic container that you can see through. And you want to make sure that there's enough room in that plastic container to allow this starter to at least double in volume. Because if you, as that starter starts to grow, it's going to rise as it fills with gas. And if you're not careful, it's going to become a crazy blob that spills over the container and gets all into your kitchen. And once you have it in the container and you mix it into a batter by hand, just go ahead and place it in a cool environment outside of direct sunlight. And when I say cool, I mean ideally your environment is 65 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 to 21 degrees Celsius. Now, after anywhere from 24 to 72 hours, you should see some bubbling occur in your starter. Now, contrary to popular belief, the bubbling at this stage isn't actually produced by yeast, but is produced by the lactobacilli bacteria, which also gives off CO2. Now, even though your starter looks nice and bubbly, it's not actually strong enough to bake with because the yeast population is still small and weak. Now, it takes about anywhere from 5 to 7 days for the yeast to become strong enough to actually bake some sourdough bread. Now, after the initial bubbling, so again, this bubbling can occur from 24 to 72 hours, depending upon your environment. After this initial bubbling, you want to pull out half your starter and throw it in the trash, and then feed half back in. So you pull out, so with our starter amount, we started with 500 grams warm water, 250 grams whole wheat flour, and 250 grams of bread flour, which gives us 1,000 grams of our starter. We're going to pull out 500 grams, and then we're going to feed back in 250 grams of water, 125 grams of whole wheat flour, and 125 grams of bread flour. So you're pulling out half, and you're feeding in half. And people always get upset with me when I tell them to throw half your starter away, but it's the price of admission. This is part of creating a healthy starter. It's part of the game. And it's in your starter's best interest. So if your starter accumulates too much acid, which is a byproduct of lactobacilli fermentation, or alcohol in the form of ethanol, which is a byproduct of both yeast and lactobacilli, then the ecosystem of the starter will become toxic. Now remember, acid, CO2, and alcohol are byproducts of bacterial and yeast fermentation. So think for a second of someone stuck you in a small box, fed you a bunch of food, but never let you go to the bathroom to rid your body's byproducts from your environment. Well, I know I may be going out on a limb here, but I'd assume that you wouldn't be very happy or healthy in that sort of environment. It's the same thing with your sourdough starter. So discarding at least half of your starter during its infancy, about the first 7 to 10 days, is really important. Now, after that, the portion which you remove from your starter can be used to bake bread. Now, can you bake with that portion beforehand? So like on the third day mark, can you pull out half and then, maybe add some commercial yeast to it and bake with it? And this is a common question that I get. And the answer is, yeah, you can, but it really, to be completely honest with you, it won't be that good. All right. So look, you just bear with me. This is only 7 to 10 days. It just takes some time. You have to be patient. This stage in building your sourdough starter requires commitment. So pull out half, feed half back in, and then you want to feed back in the same amount of flour and water you took out, making a thickish little batter, and continue this feeding for every 24 hours, preferably at the same time each day, because just like people, your starter gets used to its feeding cycle. Now, after 5 to 7 days total, you should have a starter that's strong enough to bake with. And the best way to judge this is by getting to know your starter cycle. So when you feed it, it should rise slowly over the course of 6 to 12 hours and then fall back in on itself in a predictable manner. Now, when you're ready to bake with your starter for the very first time, so this is, say, your starter is looking really strong on like day 5 or 6 or 7, and every time you feed it, it kind of rises slowly over the course of 6 to 12 hours and slowly falls back in on itself. You want to do one final feeding, and you do this by taking out half or as much as 90% of your starter, and you feed back in the same amount of starter that you took out. And over the course of the next 12 to 16 hours, you want to take out a small portion of your starter and drop it into room temperature water, just like a tablespoon. And if it floats, if your starter floats, then you know that it's producing enough carbon dioxide or CO2 gas to successfully leaven a loaf of bread. If it doesn't float, if it sinks to the bottom of the room temperature water almost immediately, then a couple of things could happen. Either your starter needs a few more days to fully strengthen itself, it's not quite there yet, or maybe just it's not fully expanded in its life cycle yet. So if you have a little bit of a less active strain of starter, or it's also too, the starter is young, so the your starter is more likely to float in a 12-hour period after it matures more. But if it's still not floating after the 12 to say 16-hour period, then give it a little more time, or maybe feed it through another feeding cycle. And you want to keep on refreshing the starter at room temperature, and storing it at room temperature to keep it nice and active over the course of 7 to 10 days until it will pass the float test after 12 to 16 hours of feeding. Now, at this point, give yourself a big old fat high five and a big old hell yes, because you are ready to bake some sourdough bread. Now, we're going to talk more about that process in our next episode, because there's a whole lot of other things that you want to take into consideration when baking sourdough bread. Now, before we move on, a couple of notes on the starter method. So first of all, whole wheat flour is used in my starter formulation because the ash or the mineral content in the flour provides lots of nutrients for the young yeast. However, we don't use 100% whole wheat flour, and some people prefer this, they really do, but I don't like to use 100% whole wheat flour because this makes the starter overly sour and a little harder to deal with in the early stages. Now, can you make it? Yeah, you can. And some people actually recommend this, especially because the more acid produced in the early stages can sometimes be more beneficial to the yeast culture, and more on this in a second. But I like to use a mixture of 50-50 bread flour and 100% whole wheat flour because this is the mixture that I use during my entire starter life cycle. And this is kind of how I keep my starter happy and thriving and going, and this is what's worked for me in the past. And then in the future, say I want to make a whole wheat sourdough starter, I'll take a very small amount of my mother's starter that's nice and strong, and I'll take off maybe like only 25 grams, and then I'll feed that into, a poolish style pre-ferment of, 500 grams whole wheat and 500 grams flour, 500 grams water, and let that sit out at room temperature. And then I can expand that, or I can retard it, or I can basically use that as a new sourdough starter that I only feed 100% whole wheat flour. But a little bit of whole wheat flour in the beginning, regardless of the style of sourdough starter that you want to create, is good, because again, that mineral or ash content gives the yeast some food to feed on, and it makes them nice and happy, and you know, allows them to thrive. Now, be careful with your tap water. Depending upon the strength of your local yeast and bacteria, the chlorine or fluoride that is put in by a lot of cities into tap water can kill or very much weaken your natural yeast strains. And this is as easy as you can just check with your local water department. If they put fluoride or chlorine into the water, just go out. I forget off the top of my head how much they cost, but you can get like a Brita filter, which is a pitcher that filters water. Or you can even just go a little bit simpler and you get like a screw-on tap filter. And that's going to take out not all of the fluoride and chlorine, but enough to allow you to successfully leaven or successfully create a sourdough starter. And I've had issues with this in the past where I'm just like, you know, well, what the hell? Why isn't my sourdough starter getting going? Why is it all weak and soupy and unhappy? Well, it just so happened that I had chlorine in my water supply, and I forgot to check that aspect of it. And once I started using filter water, my problems were solved. Now, also, too, diastic malt powder or malted barley, both commonly found at health food stores or online, as well as honey, are really good foods for yeast to consume during their youthful growth stage, during that first 7 to 10 days. Now, add a teaspoon of any of these ingredients to your mix, and it can be really helpful. It just starts to kind of strengthen your yeast over time. But after your starter strengthens, these supplements are no longer necessary. And honestly, this is just something for your own knowledge. I don't use diastic malt powder, or I don't use honey. I'm just a purist kind of guy when it comes to creating my sourdough starter. I just use flour and water, mix it by hand, and let it go. Now, with that said, there are lots of different formulations for starters out there. And quite honestly, because the subject of sourdough is clouded in a lot of dogma, there's a lot of unnecessary formulations of like, you know, add this or add a little sprinkling of my magic pixie dust over here, and that's going to give you a healthier starter. And it's all based upon anecdotal evidence. And because everyone's environment is different, then, you know, one thing might work for someone's environment, but not necessarily for another's environment. And then after a while, it just kind of evolves into culinary dogma by everyone just kind of anecdotally, you know, telling people, this is how it is. This is what needs to happen for you to create a good sourdough starter. Now, outside of this, there actually is one take on sourdough starters I find very, very fascinating, and I'm going to give you the cliff notes. And this is written by a woman named Deborah Wink, who is really active, or used to be really active, on bread baking forums. But specifically, one of my favorite bread baking forums is The Fresh Loaf. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes, because this is where I found the this article. And basically, she calls it the pineapple solution. And again, I'll put a link in episode 21 show notes. So you go to stellacolony.com/SCS21. And the basic premise of her argument is this, and she knows her science. I mean, she's, you know, a microbiologist. She's looking at this stuff under a microscope. I mean, she knows what she's talking about. And the basic premise was, well, when you first mix your flour and water together when making a natural levain, lactobacilli and wild yeast aren't the only living microorganisms in the mix in your environment. So what happens is, after the initial mixing of the flour and water, is what Wink describes basically as a microbiology relay race, in which each organism is slowly paving the way for the next by dropping the pH in a sourdough starter. Now, what occurs a lot of times when people first begin a sourdough starter is it will start to bubble and be active on the second to third day, and then stall, showing little or no activity and starting to smell kind of rank and nasty. Now, what's happening there is there's basically another kind of lactobacilli bacteria that is at first creating those bubbles and sort of slightly acidifying the environment. And then as things progress within your starter, that form of lactobacilli goes away and it no longer creates bubbles. And now you have some weaker forms of bacteria coming into the mix, which kind of start to make it smell a little bit rank and a little bit off. But as you continue to refresh and feed, then the starter will continue to acidify, and eventually it'll pave the way for the lactobacilli and the wild yeast that we need in our sourdough starters to dominate, right? So these will be the dominant organisms in our sourdough starters. And once this occurs, once they take hold, then you're home free, because the lactobacilli create an acidic environment that isn't really hospitable to other forms of bacteria that could otherwise spoil the starter. Now, again, this will pass with time. So that whole stalling thing, when you create or you mix the flour and water together, then you see some activity, then it stalls, then it starts to smell rank. This will pass with time as long as you continue to feed and refresh your starter at room temperature, but it won't necessarily be ready to bake within 7 days. It's going to take maybe a little bit longer, 10 to 12 days. But Wink had a novel solution that has worked for a lot of people. And if you want her exact process, again, I'll put a link to this in the show notes. But her solution was to add pineapple juice. And the reason why she adds pineapple juice in the early stages of her sourdough creation is because it will acidify the starter enough to create a ready-made environment for the lactobacilli and the wild yeast that are beneficial to a starter to thrive versus having that stall period. So if you're having issues with your sourdough starter stalling on you, again, you can do two things. You can, number one, just trust that your natural bacteria will take over eventually and just feed regularly. So again, once you see that initial bubbling stage, then you want to commit to 24-hour feedings where you remove half and feed back in half for 24 hours for the next 7 to 10 days or until your starter passes the float test, which could honestly take as long as 14 days. And this all depends upon the microbiology you have in your environment. Now, if you want to rush this along a little bit and you're starting to get frustrated, head on over to episode 21 show notes found at stellacolony.com/SCS21. And I'll have a link to Deborah Wink's complete sourdough starter philosophy or sourdough starter directions using that pineapple juice. Now, with that said, I do want to make you aware of the three stages of a sourdough starter, and those are infant, adolescent, and adult. Now, the infant sourdough starter is about the first 5 to 7 days where it's still kind of weak and needs to be babied. You need to store it at room temperature and refresh every 24 hours. Now, the adolescent starter is about 10 to 30 days old, and this will be strong enough to leaven bread. It will pass the float test after anywhere from 12 to 16 hours of feeding. However, your finished bread will still have a, you know, it won't be that sour. It'll have a mild complexity to it. It's almost as if you used a pre-ferment, right? So the same sort of complexity that comes from using a pre-ferment is going to come from this adolescent starter. But then after the 30-day mark, you're going to have an adult starter that's super resilient and has a really complex flavors. And the flavors of that starter can be changed or molded relatively quickly based upon the feeding schedule and the environment that it's stored in. Now, getting to know your starter is really important, all right? And the only way that you can get to know your starter is first, just like you get to know anyone else, you got to introduce yourself, say, "Hi, my name's Jacob," and your starter can only introduce itself back if you give it a name. So you have to name your starter. Why? Because it is bad luck. It is scientifically proven to be bad luck not to name your starter. And look, you can laugh at me and say, "Oh, that's so stupid you name your starter," but look, it's a living thing. It is tradition, and sometimes tradition is good. And don't come crying to me when your starter gets depressed because it has no name and it doesn't feel loved by you and it poops out and dies on you, okay? So name your starter, but honestly, all joking aside, your starter is a living thing, right? It's actually has multiple living things contained within it, and you have like this little tiny universe of flour and water mixed together in this container that's sitting in your kitchen. And getting to know how that ecosystem works, I can give you some of the science behind it, and we're going to talk more about the science behind it in our discussion segment in next episode. But really, you have to foster a feel for your environment. You have to learn what your starter is like and what it reacts to and how it reacts at cold temperature storage versus warm temperature storage and how long it takes you to refresh it if you haven't fed it for a while. And these are all things that are just going to come with time. So you have to pay attention to it. You have to sort of, well, get to know your starter. So pay attention to how it acts when you feed it. And also too, I always prefer to feed my starter by hand. So I'll remove half by hand when I'm refreshing it, and I'll feed in the flour, I'll stir in the water using my hand, because this gives me a tactile feedback, and I can kind of gauge where my starter is at based upon this feedback. So if it's feeling really soupy and loose, then I know the starter is probably hungry and there's a lot of acid and alcohol in that starter. So it's probably time to feed it. If it's really spongy and bouncy and all it has, you know, this very airy texture and quality to it, then I know it's probably at its peak of activity and a perfect time to bake with it. And, you know, I get emails all the time from people who are asking me, like, you know, well, hey, you know, this happened to my sourdough bread and this happened to my sourdough bread and then that happened. And I can give you some technical feedback sometimes. But really, number one, you have to understand that baking sourdough bread is technical. It just really is. It's just, it takes practice. You're not going to knock it out of the ballpark every single time, especially on the first try. But once you get an intuitive feel for your bread dough and for your sourdough starter, and you can only develop this intuitive feel by being patient and by working with it over time, then a lot of these issues are going to go away because you're no longer trusting on my timing based upon the environments in which I created sourdough. You're now understanding your own environment and your own starter and how it reacts. And basically, you need to look at your sourdough starter as your partner in making great bread. It is basically your bread baking assistant. And you have to get to know the people you work with, get to know your starter. And the more you get to know your starter, the better chance you're gonna have of successfully creating great bread. Now, again, we will be talking more in next episode about how your starter is influenced by environment and what you feed it. But let me just give you a sort of general equation here. So the colder storage, so the colder that you store your starter in, results in more acidic acid production. And this is the same acid present in vinegar. Warmer storage results in more lactic acid production. And for my wine drinkers in the audience, this is the same lactic acid that gives Chardonnays a buttery, almost caramel popcorn note. So in a lot of wines, especially red wine, so in France, a lot of times, almost exclusively red wines are always put through what's called malolactic fermentation. So in red wines and also in white wines, there is malic acid, and this is what gives a lot of unripe green apples their sour flavor. It can be a really overbearing sourness. So they put this using a different strain of lactobacilli bacteria. They will ferment this malic acid in a process called malolactic fermentation, where it's basically converting malic acid into lactic acid, and that lactic acid is what's present in milk. So it's a much less harsher of an acid and has a more flowery, almost sweet notes. Now, when you do this malolactic fermentation using Chardonnays, and this is done a lot in California, that a lot of, you know, that the lactic acid that's produced from the malic acid, so the Chardonnay is much less sour now, plus being aged in oak barrels and having that oaky flavor, is why California, because of this stylistic approach to making Chardonnays for the most part, has these big, round, robust, buttery Chardonnays, which some people hate, some people love. But that's why, is because the malic acid is converted to lactic acid. So the same concept holds true in your sourdough starter. So if you have more lactic acid in your sourdough starters, it's going to be less sour and a little bit more floury, milky, sweet. Now, refined flours, meaning like white flours, will produce more lactic acid, while feeding your starter whole wheat flour and other whole grains, including rye, can cause a more sour flavor by producing more acetic acid. Now, there is disagreement on whether a wetter starter produces more lactic or acetic acid as compared to a dry or Biga-style starter, but in reality, it doesn't really matter because all forms of lactobacillus, which are responsible for lactic and acetic acid production, actually prefer wetter starters, but you'll have to wait until next episode because this topic gets, you know, when I get going on this topic, it takes a lot of time. So we'll talk more about that in our discussion segment. Now, once your sourdough starter is established and ready to rock, you basically use this just like a pre-ferment. And this is why we cover pre-ferments in our discussion segment, because now that you have a sourdough starter, you can basically create pre-ferments using natural yeast. So you can create a poulet-style pre-ferment where you mix a small portion of the flour and water from the bread dough that you want to make, and you inoculate that with your sourdough starter. You let it pre-ferment overnight. You can use the poulet-style where it's mainly 100% hydration, or you can use delayed fermentation, or you can delay fermentation even more through a Biga-style starter because you're using a lower hydration rate. And we're going to talk more about that in the future. We're in our next episode. But basically, the sourdough starter is then used as a pre-ferment to leaven bread. Now, for long-term storage, you can place both the Biga or the Poolish style of starter in your fridge. Once your Poolish starter is established and you've, you know, it's at least in the adolescent stage, so it's, you know, older than 10 days old, and you've baked a couple of loaves of bread with it, you know it's nice and strong enough to leaven bread, then you can put it in a suspended animation. You can put it into long-term storage. And the way that you do this is you want to dump out 90% of your active starter, leaving 10% behind. And this is just going to allow a smaller population of yeast and lactobacilli a longer period of time to eat through your flour and water. Feed back in the same 90% that you took out, and then place in the back of your fridge. And you want to cover with a tight-fitting lid. And sometimes people get worried. I always put plastic wrap over my my sourdough starters, or a tight-fitting lid over my sourdough starters. And people always ask me, well, doesn't the lactobacilli and the yeast, doesn't it need oxygen to survive? You know, isn't it going to, you know, choke out and die? And the answer is actually no, because although there are metabolic pathways in which both the wild yeast and the lactobacillus bacteria can respirate, all that oxygen in a bread dough is used up very, very quickly. So they go through alternative metabolic pathways through anaerobic fermentation, meaning they do not need oxygen to continue to live and thrive and multiply. And the reason why you want to put a tight-fitting lid on your starter, especially when you place it into long-term storage, is number one, you don't want it to dry out. But number two, which is much more likely, is the fact that as the yeast and the lactobacilli, as they continue to slowly go through their metabolic pathways or their anaerobic fermentation in your refrigerator, they're going to go through all of the food and they're going to be like, hey man, like, dude, this party totally sucks. Like, this dude over here just stinks and like all the food's gone. Like, I'm going to sleep. And that's what's going to happen. They're going to go to sleep. But only after they go through pretty much all of their food. And when that happens, the starter itself is going to be highly acidic and contain a ton of ethanol, which is alcohol. So it's going to smell like, you know, really like a just strong vinegar mixed with strong, cheap alcohol, which really isn't pleasant. And if this is allowed to sit uncovered in your fridge for an extended period of time, then it's going to make everything in your fridge smell like cheap booze and cheap vinegar. So you want to keep a nice tight lid on it. And then when you look at the starter, don't be alarmed, because the starter will be really soupy and loose. And this is because the acid produced by the yeast and the lactobacilli weakens any gluten strands that you have in that flour, making it soupy. So there's less gluten structure, which makes the starter appear to be more soupy. But also, too, what happens is the yeast and the lactobacilli go through, they eat the starches, which are a solid, in the starter, and they convert some of that starch into alcohol. So you're actually going to have a higher percentage of alcohol in your starter, which is going to make it seem more soupy. Now, this can be left in your fridge almost indefinitely. Now, I've never gone longer than 9 months of this in my fridge, but I've always been able to bring it back. And here's how you bring it back: is a couple of days before you want to start baking sourdough bread again, you pull out your soupy starter and you discard everything except for about 100 to 200 grams of the starter. And then you want to feed it its weight in flour and water, again, using the Poolish style formulation. So if I pull out 200 grams of starter that's been sitting in my fridge for a few months, it's all soupy and stuff, then I'm going to feed that 200 grams 100 grams of flour and 100 grams of water. And because I like to have a 50-50 mix of whole wheat flour and bread flour, then I'm really going to be feeding that 200 grams of old starter 50 grams whole wheat flour, 50 grams bread flour, and 100 grams of water. Now, the following day, I'm going to have 400 grams of starter. So I'm going to expand this again, which a lot of bakers call elaborations, but basically it's just an expansion, by, again, feeding it its total weight in flour and water. So because I have 400 grams of starter, now I'm going to feed it 100 grams of whole wheat, 100 grams of bread flour, and 200 grams of water. And so you can kind of see this expansion process taking place. Now, after 72 hours or 3 expansion feedings, where each time I'm feeding the starter the same amount, it should be pretty close to ready to bake and vigorous and ready to go. Now, if you feel like you're getting too much starter on hands by expanding out, then on the second or third day, you can just easily toss off half your starter, feed half back in, and then continue on. But it's going to take you about 3 days to 4 days total of taking your starter out of the fridge, out of suspended animation, and then feeding it to bring it back. Now, you can also do a long-term storage by using a biga, and basically what you're doing is you're taking your biga, and which is about 60% hydration, and then you bury that in whole wheat flour, and then you take this container of whole wheat flour with your biga buried inside it, and you stick it in the back of your fridge. Now, after 6 months or whenever you feel like baking sourdough bread again, you'll take that biga, you'll unbury it from the flour, you carve off the dry exterior, which kind of will yield a semi-firm dough in the middle, and then you take this dough and then you expand it using the same elaboration process that we do our poolish. So if you have, you know, again, 200 grams of this solid biga style starter that's been stored in whole wheat flour for a long time, I would, again, because I prefer to use a poolish style starter with my sourdough formulations, I would just start feeding this, 100 or 1-to-1 mixture of flour and water, continue to expand it out, and it'll become fairly liquid. And then once it's nice and floury and bubbly and ready to pass the float test, then you're going to dump most of it out anyways and refeed fresh flour and water back in. Then wait your 12 to 14 hours and go into your sourdough bread baking process. Now, one thing I did want to mention that happens quite commonly before we move on, I get questions about this all the time when people are creating their sourdough starters, is after a day or two, they'll come and the sourdough starter will be nice and active and friendly and ready to rock. And then they wake up one morning and they go to feed it, and oh my goodness, like there's a bunch of brown liquid floating on top of my sourdough starter. Did it die? Did I kill it? Oh my God, what do I do? Well, what that is it's called hooch, and it's basically pure ethyl alcohol with other stuff mixed in. And the miners, the old crusty miners in Alaska during the Klondike Gold Rush, they were actually called sourdoughs because they'd always carry around sourdough starters with them. And they would take this hooch off the top and they would drink it because it's almost pure ethyl alcohol. And it supposedly gives you really, really horrid, horrid, horrid hangovers. I mean, you're basically better off, drinking rubbing alcohol. So do not try that at home. But that's part of, you know, what those crazy guys did. But what that's telling you is that your starter is hungry and it's active. So what could be happening is where you're storing your starter at could be too warm. So if your room temperature is above 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it's going to cause your wild yeast to be more active. It's going to go through its food supply faster. As it runs out of its food, it's just going to be keep on producing that alcohol as a byproduct. And then you're going to come and you're going to look and it's going to be overproduced with alcohol, or your starter is going to be really, really loose and soupy. And that's just because it contains a lot of alcohol. So there's a couple of ways to solve this. Is number one, when you see this happen, pour off the alcohol first, then remove half of the starter after you've removed the alcohol, and then feed back in the same amount of the starter that you took out and refresh it that way. Double check your room temperature. If your room temperature is above 70 degrees Fahrenheit, you might want to look at storing it in a cooler place or a cooler climate. You can even retard it in your fridge. And then when you pull it out from your fridge, you're going to want to let it set at room temperature and then do one more feeding at room temperature before baking your sourdough, just to make sure that it's nice and active. But another option available to you is to just pull out more when you refresh or feed. So instead of pulling out 50% or half of the total weight of your starter, you can pull out as much as 80 to 90% and then feed 80 to 90% back in. And what that is going to do is it compensates for the fact that you have an extra active starter, and just giving it more food to go through and to eat before it starts to get unhappy and produce a bunch of alcohol and kind of start to die on you. My contribution be most definitely political, subliminal, partially, hardly any filler of that about the process. I'm thinking progress over literary garbage, harness. These words sicken me, the future set up a bet. Even when dealing with the corporate structure, power is given up to those who repeat. All right, so this episode's homework assignment is to make a sourdough starter, and I want you to go through the process and make a poolish sourdough starter. And I'll link to my sourdough starter video in the show notes and some other recipes you can play around with. So you can get those show notes at you can get those show notes at stellaculinary.com/SCS21. And you can do this. You can create a sourdough starter. I have faith in you, and you need to make it now, because in about the next 10 to 14 days, I'm going to be releasing SES episode 22, which is going to be talking about the sourdough bread baking process. So you want to make sure that you have your sourdough starter ready to rock for that podcast episode. Now, also as some extra credit bonus homework, you can go and take one of our bread recipes, and I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm thinking either the baguette recipe or our white bread recipe, both of which use the direct method, and then convert them into an indirect method, pulling off a portion of that flour and that water and creating a pre-ferment, which is going to give you a better finished loaf of bread. So this is me kind of taking the training wheels off a little bit and sending you down the path of applying the technique of a pre-ferment and showing you that if, you know, just with a little bit of thought and a little bit of math, you can basically take any bread recipe out there and make it better by utilizing a pre-ferment, especially if it's just a direct dough method. So again, your homework is to go out and create a sourdough starter and then convert a bread recipe that uses the direct dough method to a pre-ferment, and then for some extra Stella stars, which are kind of like bonus points, go over to stellaculinary.com and the SES 21 show notes and post a picture in the comment section and tell me how your formulation and your conversion came out. And also, too, if you have any questions or if you're having any difficulties on making your sourdough starter, post them at stellaculinary.com/SES21, and I'll answer them there. We also have some of our smart community members who will be there answering some of your questions, and I might even drop them into a Q&A segment in our next episode. All right, real quick, before we get going, I know this episode went long, but I do have a couple of quick announcements for you. The first thing is, I really want you to be a part, an active member of the Stella Culinary community and go and interact on our forums. And this is an important part in your education. It really is. Because the more you teach, the better you master a skill. So as I teach these new skills to you, as you learn stuff, not only through the Stella Culinary School podcast and all the videos that I post on our website, but as you learn information from other avenues, whether it be other blogs, other books, whatever, you can practice that knowledge or solidify that knowledge by answering questions in the SES community, because we have a forum where you can go and you can create a new forum topic and you can post questions. And one of the things that I love about the SES community is the fact that it's super friendly and people aren't, you know, some of the times you find some unfriendly people online on forums and they can kind of get a little testy with the new people. But we always welcome the new people with open arms, and we're looking there to answer your question and to really, we all have the same shared goal, which is to become better cooks. And we do that by sharing our information freely and by not making anyone feel stupid about not knowing something, because all of us started out not knowing anything about cooking. No one has started with the knowledge, or no one is born with the knowledge of being a great cook. So we all had to learn it from somewhere, right? So my idea behind this forum and this community is that we basically localize all of the information, and we give you a place where you can ask your questions and get them answered. Now, with that said, internet forum spam, especially on the Stella Culinary website, which is, you know, rapidly growing, is a massive, massive issue. So what I do is I have spam filters, and they're turned up really high because these spammers are getting a lot better at bypassing spam filters, especially weak ones. So I have them turned up really, really high, which makes it sometimes frustrating for new members to create comments, because if they're new, they create a comment and they get caught up in the spam filters and like, well, what the heck? I had a question asked, but you know, now it's not even being posted. I'm getting caught in the spam filters. So what I did is this, and this is kind of an exclusive for my Stella Culinary School podcast listenership, because I figure if you've listened to me ramble about sourdough starters and pre-ferments this long, then you're kind of a fan of the podcast and you are definitely not a spammer. So here's what I want you to do is go to stellaculinary.com. If you don't have a username, register for one. If you do have a username, you want to log in to your username. Once you are logged in to your Stella Culinary username, go to stellaculinary.com/trusted. That's stellaculinary.com /trusted, T-R-U-S-T-E-D. And what this will do, this is an unpublished link. When you go to stellacoloni.com/trusted, the only way for you to get this link is if I share it with you through either, you know, Facebook or through this podcast. And the website will automatically recognize your username and it will add you to our Stella Trusted user group, meaning that you can now post any comment or question on the Stella Culinary website and not get caught up in our spam filters and not be frustrated by that. Because again, you asking questions and you also answering questions is going to be a very, very important part in continuing your education and solidifying your knowledge and becoming a great cook. So I want to make it as easy for you as possible. But please, please, please go to stellacoloni.com, register for a free username, and start interacting in our forums and start solidifying your knowledge by asking and answering questions. Now also too, if you haven't already, I want you to sign up for our free email newsletter. And look, I've been a little bit lax in this in the past. I haven't really been as active as I'd like to be, but hey, I am bringing it back. And right now we have a really cool bonus for people who are signed up for our email newsletter, and that is a seasonal produce buying guide. And this gives you a season by season breakdown of all the produce that is in season during spring, winter, summer, fall, and also the hyper seasonal breakdown on a month to month basis. And this is going to help you plan your menus in advance and also make sure that you're starting off with the best quality ingredients by buying the proper seasonal ingredients. So head on over to stellacoloni.com and click on the newsletter link at the top of our webpage, and that will bring you to a place where you can sign up for our email newsletter. You can get this bonus, and you'll also get updated information for when I release a new podcast episode, when I release a new video, or any of our other educational content. And I'm also working on some more bonus material that you will only get if you are signed up for our email newsletter, basically as a thank you for being a super fan of Stella Culinary and by allowing me to harass you with emails every now and then. Now, again, I never send spam, but you know, I will send you an email when we come up with a new podcast episode or when we announce our dates for our boot camp. You know, we'll send out an email for that. And one of the things that I'm working on for next episode is I will be creating two bonus video lectures that will only be available for our newsletter list. And those two videos are going to be converting commercial yeast recipes to sourdough. So you can take any recipe or bread recipe out there that uses commercial yeast and you can easily convert it into a sourdough bread recipe, thus making it a better finished loaf of bread. And also a separate video on how to create your own sourdough recipes. Now, I am working on some more email newsletter only bonuses, so sign up now because you'll only get those bonuses when they come available through the email newsletter list, and they won't always be available for long periods of time. So they will go into the archives. So to make sure that you're not missing any of this content, go to stellacoloni.com and sign up for our email newsletter. And in the process, when you sign up and you get that welcome email newsletter, use it as an opportunity to hit that reply button and ask me any question that you want to know about food and cooking. So as a special extra bonus gift to you right now, I'm telling you, sign up for our email newsletter. When you get that confirmation email and that welcome email, click the reply button and ask me a question. It can be about bread. It can be about cooking. It can be about being a professional chef or breaking into the industry. Really anything that you want. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. I know we went a little bit long today, but I hope you got a lot of great information on sourdough starters and pre-ferments. This episode's show notes found at stellacoloni.com/SCS21. And stay tuned for next episode where we talk all about how to make some great sourdough bread.